At that time, there lived in the great city of Vaishali a certain Lichavi, Vimalakirti by name. Having served the ancient Buddhas, he had generated the roots of virtue by honouring them and making offerings to them. He had attained patience as well as eloquence. He played with the great supernologies. He had attained the power of incantations and the fearlessnesses. He had conquered all demons and opponents. He had penetrated the profound way of the Dharma. He was liberated through the transcendence of wisdom. Having integrated his realization with skillful means, he was expert in knowing the thoughts and actions of living beings, knowing the strength or weakness of their faculties, and being gifted with unrivaled eloquence, he taught the Dharma appropriately to each. Having applied himself energetically to the Mahayana, he understood it and accomplished his tasks with great finesse. He lived with the deportment of a Buddha, and his superior intelligence was as wide as an ocean. He was praised, honoured and commended by all the Buddhas and was respected by all the gods and all the protectors of the world. In order to develop living beings with his skillful means, he lived in the great city of Vaishali. His wealth was inexhaustible for the purpose of sustaining the poor and the helpless. He observed a pure morality in order to protect the immoral. He maintained patience and self-control in order to reconcile beings who were angry, cruel, violent and brutal. He blazed with energy in order to inspire people who were lazy. He maintained concentration, mindfulness and meditation in order to sustain the mentally troubled. He attained decisive wisdom in order to sustain the foolish. He wore the white clothes of the layman, yet lived impeccably like a renunciate. He lived at home, but remained aloof from the realm of desire, the realm of pure form, and the formless realm. He appeared to have a son, a wife, and female attendants, yet always maintained celibacy. He appeared to be surrounded by servants, yet lived in solitude. He appeared to be adorned with ornaments, yet always was endowed with the auspicious signs and marks. He seemed to eat and drink, yet always took nourishment from the taste of meditation. He made his appearance at the fields of sports and in the casinos, but his aim was always to mature those people who were attached to games and gambling. He visited the fashionable heterodox teachers, yet always kept unswerving loyalty to the Buddha. He understood the mundane and transcendental sciences and esoteric practices, yet always took pleasure in the delights of the Dharma. He mixed in all crowds, yet was respected as foremost of all. In order to be in harmony with people, he associated with elders, with those of middle age and with the young, yet always spoke in harmony with the Dharma. He engaged in all sorts of businesses, yet had no interest in profit or possessions. To train living beings, he would appear at crossroads and on street corners, and to protect them, he participated in government. To turn people away from the lesser vehicle and to engage them in the great vehicle, he appeared among listeners and teachers of the Dharma. To develop children, he visited all the schools. To demonstrate the evils of desire, he even entered the brothels. To establish drunkards in correct mindfulness, he entered all the cabarets. He was honoured as the businessman among businessmen, because he demonstrated the priority of the Dharma. He was honoured as the landlord among landlords, because he renounced the aggressiveness of ownership. He was honoured as the warrior among warriors, because he cultivated endurance, determination and fortitude. He was honoured as the aristocrat among aristocrats, because he suppressed pride, vanity and arrogance. He was honoured as the official among officials, because he regulated the functions of government according to the Dharma. He was honoured as the prince of princes, because he reversed their attachment to royal pleasures and sovereign power. He was honoured as a eunuch in the royal harem, because he taught the young ladies according to the Dharma. He was compatible with ordinary people, because he appreciated the excellence of ordinary virtues. He was honoured as the Indra among Indras, because he showed them the temporality of their lordship. He was honoured as the Brahma among Brahmas, because he showed them the special excellence of Gnosis. He was honoured as the Lokapala among Lokapalas, because he fostered the development of all living beings. Thus lived the Lich of Vimalakirti in the great city of Vaishali, endowed with an infinite knowledge of skillful means. At that time, out of this very skillful means, Vimalakirti manifested himself as if sick. To inquire after his health, the king, the officials, the lords, the youths, the aristocrats, the householders, the businessmen, the town folk, the country folk, and thousands of other living beings came forth from the great city of Vaishali and called upon the Lichavi Vimalakirti. So there we are. That's your introduction to Vimalakirti, whose name means something like stainless radiance or stainless famed, or the pure famed, or even stainless glory. And yes, as Gnanavacha said, the Vimalakirti Nidesha, the exposition of Vimalakirti, is another one of these Mahayana sutras. And as with the White Lotus Sutra, it's a Mahayana sutra that our teacher Sangharakshita has given a whole series of lectures on in about, I think, 1979, not long after the completion of the building of, or the conversion of this place into the London Buddhist Centre. And he said at the time that one of the things he wanted to do in that lecture series was to raise everybody to a transcendental plane, at least for a little while. Because the Vimalakirti Nidesha is a really, a sublime, profound, and indeed magical sutra with all sorts of strange and wonderful things going on within it. Just to give you a little sample of one of the things that happens in the sutra. I don't know if you've come across this notion in Mahayana Buddhism of what they call the pure land, or the pure Buddha field, an environment which is completely conducive to the practice of the Dharma. The most famous is Sakavati, the land of bliss, not the men's community upstairs. That is a sort of aspiring to be like that, but in the most famous pure land is Sakavati, the land of bliss. And in the land of bliss, and the Buddha of that realm is the Buddha of infinite light, Amitabha. All you have to do is sit on your lotus flower, which you've been magically reborn on, and all you have to do is listen to the Dharma. And the whole land is constantly singing. All the birds, for example, are singing impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, insubstantiality. And you've just got to sit there and just be receptive to the Dharma being taught to you. I'll say something a bit more generally about pure lands. But in this sutra, there is another pure land that pops up called sweetly perfumed with all perfumes. And in this perfumed, the Buddha, whose name is something like heap of perfumes, the Dharma is taught entirely in terms of perfume. So the Bodhisattvas in this realm sit under jewel trees, and there's just this constant array of different perfumes and scents which are communicating reality, communicating the nature of the Dharma, the nature of truth to you. The Buddha in that realm is like, I guess, a perfume DJ, constantly, you know, wafting new scents to raise people of level of consciousness. And anyway, there's a whole kind of discussion of different pure lands at this particular point about how there are all sorts of ways in which the Buddha will in a particular world will communicate the Dharma to the beings in those realms according to their particular needs. Apparently there are pure lands where the Dharma is taught entirely in terms of clothing. It's like a sort of transcendental fashion show, like Lama's pajamas, but gone crazy, you know, that it's Alexander McQueen gone transcendental or something like that, whatever your favourite fashion designer is, I don't know. You just look at this gear and you're off, you're away. You know, there's all sorts of things like this. Sounds, music, that's another one. Silence. There are Buddha lands where there's just silence. Just silence. There's a Buddha land. Akasha Mitra, here's one for you. There's one which is just space. The radiance of space. Akasha Mitra means the friend of radiant space or something like that, isn't it, I think. So there's pure lands like that where reality is just taught entirely in terms of space. We, in fact, are occupying a Buddha field as well. But unlike these other Buddha fields, this Buddha field is known as an impure Buddha field because we're not up to, you know, just getting off on perfumes or something like that. And in this Buddha field, the Buddha teaches the Dharma, teaches the path in terms of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, insubstantiality, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and all the kind of classic practices. And in this particular sutra, the bodhisattvas who live in this perfuming pure land, they are just amazed at the profundity of the teaching in this realm, in our realm. They think it's amazing that the Dharma gets taught in that very, very down-to-earth way, and as we are amazed by the world of perfumes. So yes, there's this theme of these pure Buddha fields, these environments that are perfectly conducive to Dharma practice. And one of the big themes in this sutra, early on in this sutra, there's a whole discussion about how does a bodhisattva create or build a Buddha field? How does he create an environment which is totally conducive to Dharma development, to developing in the Dharma? It's a very, very interesting area. And when Sangharakshita discusses it, he's saying, well, why on earth do you want, why do you describe a Buddhist life in terms of creating a Buddha field, creating a world which is completely conducive to the development of the individual, to the liberation of the individual? Why would you do that? Why is that a way of describing the Buddhist life? I think it's related very strongly to what Jnanavacha was saying. It's very strong what Jnanavacha was saying about the way we can so easily turn a life devoted to meditation and relaxation and, you know, Buddhist thought and all that sort of thing into something very, very self-serving, a sort of refined hedonism and, you know, something, you know, rather self-indulgent. You know, we can even sort of get off on, you know, developing love for all living beings. In the old days when I used to lead meditation classes, you often used to see people looking quite grim in the first four stages and then this big smile in the last stage. You think, oh, I know what's going on. Humanity's become an abstraction. And they're getting off on all these good thoughts to people. But where, you know, when it comes to actual people, it's a bit different. And it's very, very easy to do that. It's very easy to lead a Buddhist life where you sort of slightly self-congratulatory, you know, I'm leading this, you know, very worthy life. As a counter to that, we need this other perspective that the Buddhist life isn't just about our own personal transformation. It must involve the recreation, the regeneration of the world around us. It must involve affecting other people. If it's not affecting other people, it's not really affecting ourselves. You know, we know very well that if we live generously and kindly, yes, that has an impact on other people, but it has a transforming effect on us equally. The deeper we go into our own meditation, our own understanding, the more we work on ourselves and change ourselves, that affects other people. Both have to be there for a healthy, well, not just a healthy Buddhist life, but a healthy human life. There has to be individual transformation and the work to enable others to follow that path of transformation as well. It's reciprocal. So you need to think in terms not just of, yes, becoming a Buddha, being reborn as an enlightened being, reborn even in this life, making progress yourself. You need equally to think in terms of, what can I do? How can I act in such a way as to make this world, yes, this whole world, into a Buddha field, a Buddha land, where it's everything is conducive for the development of the individual. You can actually, in his discussion of this in his lecture, Sangharakshita, a lecture called Building the Buddha Land, he also points out that you can create sort of pure Buddha fields, pure Buddha lands within impure ones. You can create environments within the world, oases if you like, where it's all conducive to your and others' liberation. In the Vimalakirti Nidesha, there's a description of Vimalakirti's house, this amazing house. It's a bit weird in the sutra because at a certain point in the sutra, when everybody's coming to see him, Vimalakirti makes his house disappear. It says even the doorkeeper disappears. It just vanishes. So Vimalakirti's just on a couch, ill, in the middle of space. And yet a bit later on, there's a whole discussion about his house. And it's got eight wonderful qualities. I won't go into all the qualities, but one really struck me. That as soon as anybody enters that house, whoever they are, enters Vimalakirti's house, immediately they no longer feel oppressed and troubled by their kleshas, by their defilements. They no longer feel troubled by their fear, by their craving, by their hatred, by their doubt, by their faint-heartedness. They have a rest just for a while from those things. As soon as they enter the premises, the whole atmosphere of the place is just enabling them to be free of that, have relief from that. There's other very esoteric sort of qualities as well. You know, the place is always visited by Buddhas, and there's always the sound of drums and music sounding the Dharma all the time. But I really like that one, that as soon as you enter, the atmosphere changes within you. You're in a different, an entirely different space. And what an example, what an ideal for a Buddhist centre. You know, the atmosphere in a Buddhist centre should surely be like that. As soon as you walk across the threshold, I'm having a break from, you know, all the kind of usual stuff that goes on. We need that break so that we can work, you know, more attentively on what we need to work on and what's most meaningful. It's very interesting. I was here on Friday night for the hustings for the candidates for the election, Bethnal Green and Bow. And I noticed that they looked slightly uptight to begin with, but they actually relaxed, especially after the meditation and Manjusia and Tradasiddhi's lovely welcome. And they were so polite to each other and so polite to, you know, the audience. There was no sort of, there wasn't really any party political grandstanding. I mean, they mentioned their policies, and I couldn't help but wonder if it was something to do with the atmosphere here. I thought, well, maybe they're having a break from the kleshas as well. Maybe they're having a nice break from the usual kind of, you know, rough and tumble. And I felt very good that they'd been given something by the Buddhist Centre. You know, it was, anyway, maybe that's my fantasy, maybe that's in my own mind, but I thought something magical was happening there. So if you're involved in the centre, you know, and you're involved in this class, I know there are sent class teams and things like that, and, you know, some of you come here very often. Well, think, the atmosphere you're generating, it's not just for you, it's for everybody, you know, that comes in here, that just comes off the street. And you're creating something which, you know, people can have a break from the usual kind of oppressions that affect them. And we need that break. We need that space, like I say, to make real progress so that we can go back, so we can go out and really affect the world around us and people in our workplace and families and in our communities and so on. So this sutra on the Vimalakirti Nidesha, one of its themes is this creation of you know, lands, environments which are conducive to liberation, maturing, developing along the path of the Dharma. And related to that is the big theme of skillful means. In some ways, that's one of the main teachings. Skillful means is actually a big theme of the Lotus Sutra that you're doing most of the time. That's all about skillful means. How do you bring people into a big vision of the Dharma, a big vision of the path, which is nothing less than the liberation of all life into enlightenment? That's what Mahayana means, the great way that carries everybody to Buddhahood. How do you, you know, bring that to people without freaking them out? You know, how do you show that to them skillfully in a way that is attractive and brings them along? That's one way of looking at skillful means. In this sutra, skillful means is looked at in another way. There's this invocation of this person, this mysterious person, Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti's skillful means is basically to do with he can communicate with anybody and everybody. He's not afraid of anybody and everybody, whether it's high government officials, whether it's, you know, the king and the princes, whether it's drunkards and, you know, lawbreakers, you know, whoever it is, whether it's, you know, fancy, fashionable, you know, teachers teaching all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff, whether it's children, whether it's young people, whether it's old people, whether it's middle-aged people, whoever it is, he can establish rapport. He can get into communication. He can do the really profound stuff. He can do the deep kind of metaphysical stuff. He can do the sort of magical stuff. And yet he can also, and I love this thing, he can communicate with ordinary people because he appreciates ordinary virtues. I really love that. It's really important. You know, he really appreciates ordinary, if you like, human beings and can connect with them, as well as all this other stuff. It's a fantastic evocation of upaya kushalya, as it's called, skillful means. And sometimes in your Buddhist reading, or if you're chatting to, you know, maybe Buddhists who've been around a bit, you might hear the word skillful means used. And sometimes it's used as a rationalization for all sorts of dodgy behavior. You know, all sorts of dodgy behavior. You know, I've even heard, you know, dare I say, even, you know, brothers of mine in the Dharma, you know, getting involved, you know, with somebody, you know, in that intimate way, and even saying, well, skillful means. Oh, right, you're doing it out of wisdom and compassion, are you? Or something like that. Skillful means. So if you ever come across that, be very, very wary. If you ever come across Buddhists invoking skillful means to rationalise any kind of self-indulgent behaviour, well, put your, you know, get your sword of wisdom out and chop off the wrong view rather sharply, because They're in a dodgy place. Skillful means, upaya kushalya, is a very, very high attainment. It's a very, very high attainment. In the traditional scheme of the Dharma, it's the seventh paramita of perfection of a bodhisattva. It comes after wisdom. After wisdom, you then get the perfection of skillful means. So after the bodhisattva has seen deeply into the profound nature of emptiness and signlessness and wishlessness and seeing the illusory nature of all phenomena, then out of the great love, the great compassion, there comes this skillful means. Skillful means seem to be a way in which it's describing both the kind of unity of wisdom and compassion in a way that's highly effective, highly attuned to the individual. It's just the right thing that they need to practice the Dharma. In some of you might be familiar with the Five Buddha Mandala. And in the Five Buddha Mandala, which is a wonderful description of enlightenment, you have this figure, Amoghasiddhi, the green Buddha who makes the fearlessness gesture. Well, Amoghasiddhi, who's sometimes called the sun at midnight, he's very, very mysterious. He's the Buddha of action. And he is the Buddha of skillful means. And his action is described as extremely subtle indeed, extremely subtle, extremely precise. So when you hear about skillful means, it's very important to, it's something in a sense we can't do. I think we have to, it's something really rather that we need to revere and wonder at and open up to. I mean, that description of Vimalakirti is that, that evocation. Well, it's the evocation of enlightened activity. It's the evocation of Buddha activity. It's something very, very deep and profound. Something to be inspired by, moved by, something even to aspire to. Yes, something we can aspire to be like that. I mean, I find that, well, just an absolute, such an incredibly attractive ideal that's evoked by Vimalakirti. Somebody who can tune in to everybody, and yet there is no loss of wisdom, no loss of purity, you know, no loss of that profound depth. You know, the image of the lotus flower is often invoked at this point. You know, growing a lotus has its roots in the mud, but the flower is very definitely above the mud. In the same way that Vimalakirti, the embodiment of skillful means, is in the world, really connected with all the aspirations and desires and difficulties of people in this world, and yet is not of the world, not defined by the world in any way. What an incredibly attractive ideal. I'd love to be like that one day when I grow up. I'd like to be that in many lifetimes. But there is, so having said, in a way, it's something we can't do, there is a sense in which we can start to do it. We can move towards it. And and when we talk like this, we need to think of Vimalakirti a bit differently. In the sutra, there is no description of him. There's no picture of him. It doesn't say Vimalakirti, you know, had a shaved head or had long hair or had a beard, or it says he wore the white robes of a layman, but that's about it. And as far as I know, in Indian and Tibetan art, there's no depiction of Vimalakirti. But in China, especially, and in Japan, you do get paintings, especially, and even wonderful reliefs of Vimalakirti. In China, and especially, the Vimalakirti Nidesha was a really important sutra, very big inspiration for people in China, Buddhists in China. And he's usually depicted as a very old man with a long, wispy beard and moustache and wearing the robes of a scholar, I think a Confucian scholar. So he has that kind of image, but extremely venerable. But in the sutra, we're not told kind of what he looks like. We have to imagine that. And when you actually look at all the things that he does, you start to wonder, well, actually, could one person do all that? And in fact, in the stories of him in the sutra, he's a figure that just pops up. There's all sorts of stories. In particular, the Buddha asks, after finding out that Vimalakirti is sick, he asks different disciples if they'll go and see Vimalakirti and inquire on behalf of the Buddha how he is. And each one by one, said, I can't go. I really don't want to go and see that man. And the Buddha says, well, why don't you want to go? And they say, well, on a certain occasion, I was meditating. And suddenly Vimalakirti popped up and said, told me that is not the way to meditate. You're meditating wrong. You're meditating selfishly. You're not meditating aware of others. You know, and he said, and this particular disciple said, after Vimalakirti talked to me, I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. I was dumbfounded. You know, there's all sorts of stories like this. Somebody's teaching the Dharma to somebody, Vimalakirti pops up. He says, that is not the way to teach the Dharma to these people. You're talking down to these people. You're talking at far too low a level. Can't you see that they're all potential bodhisattvas? Actually, the teaching they need is much greater than the one that you're teaching. They're capable of so much more. I'm hoping at this point Vimalakirti doesn't come through the door and give me a talking to. Oh! Thank you, Sam. Thank you very much. And, you know, then Vimalakirti teaches the Dharma, and sure enough, up comes the bodhicitta. They're on the path, and the poor disciple is just, again, dumbfounded. You know, he shows their limitations. Vimalakirti Sangharakshita says he's like a vajra. He has this kind of diamond, thunderbolt, lightning bolt kind of quality, showing the limitations of the practice of these great disciples and teachers, and opening up a much bigger perspective. So he's a sort of figure that very, very hard to pin down. And perhaps it's much better to think of Vimalakirti as, well, Sangharakshita has said that in the end, a bodhisattva becomes a transpersonal stream of consciousness. It's not just one person. That's what we're aiming for in our Dharma life. You know, that when you recite the words at the end of the puja, just as the earth and other elements are serviceable in many ways to the infinite number of beings inhabiting limitless space, so may I become that which maintains all beings. So we're aspiring to be like those elements. We're aspiring to completely go beyond ourselves, to go beyond ourselves. Just simply as an individual, to transcend into something else, to be part of this stream working for the Dharma. I know that sounds cosmic, but that is where you're headed in your Dharma life. And in the White Lotus Sutra, there is a bodhisattva who keeps telling people, well, it's going to happen. You will do it. You will become a Buddha like this. And the people get really angry with him because they say, I don't want to be like that. And they start stoning him. Sangharakshita thought that bodhisattva wasn't particularly wise, you know, in doing that, because perhaps he was taking away people's individual agency. But anyway, back to Vimalakirti. Yes, so perhaps we need to approach Vimalakirti rather differently. Perhaps we need to approach the whole topic of skillful means of creating something like a Buddha field differently. Perhaps we need to think of it much more as a community. Vimalakirti is a sort of community that perhaps we can even ourselves, as a community, aspire to be like Vimalakirti. That, in other words, we all have a part to play in the creation, in the purification of the Buddha field, in creating, yes, a land conducive for the Dharma within a land that's, well, very difficult in many ways. We've all got something to do, some part to play in that, in harmony, you know, with one another. And it's very interesting going through some of the things that Vimalakirti does, teaching the Dharma, of course, in different ways, but also going to schools to teach children. Well, order members and others go to schools. Schools come here to the Buddhist Centre, regulating the functions of government. Well, we did have the candidates here the other night. I'm not sure that we were regulating the functions of government, but there was, you know, some sort of influence. There's so many different ways in which, and, you know, we haven't even sort of started yet, we're only beginning, but there's so many different ways in which, as a spiritual community, we're all involved and connected with somebody involved in bringing the Dharma to these different areas of life. Businesses, you know, for example, there's a little one up the road, you know, which again plays a big, I know it plays quite an important part in the local community. I've seen it. I've seen people from the local community going there, not just to buy things, but to have positive connection with the Buddhists working there, and so on and so forth. I noticed this thing about the mentally troubled, that Vimalakirti has deep meditation practice in order to help people who are mentally troubled. Well, we don't just have meditation for the attainment of enlightenment and so on. Well, we have mindfulness teaching, you know, downstairs in breathing space and so on and so forth. So we're all of these things enrich the community, contribute to the development of an environment which meets people where they are, so that they can move along in their life so that they can mature and ripen in their life. So we can invoke Vimalakirti for us as a whole community. And there's a particular set of practices which are traditionally described as the way in which you perfect skillful means, the way in which a bodhisattva improves and perfects his practice of skillful means. These are very practical. They're called the Sangraha Vastus. There are four of them. In fact, they're not just the Sangraha Vastus, which you could translate as something like the means of unification. I'll say something about those that phrase in a moment. There's that set. There's another set of four called the Pratisamvids, which can be translated like something like analytical knowledges, analytical wisdoms. Very, very interesting set indeed. And there's another set called the Dharanis, or the magical incantations. So a bodhisattva practices these two sets of four, the means of unification and the analytical knowledges and the magical incantations. Practicing those, he practices skillful means. I'd love to go through all of them, but I suspect, knowing the way I go on, I'll just have to stay with the Sangraha Vastus, which are perhaps the most accessible. So I want to talk about this set of four called the means of unification. This phrase, means of unification, has been explained by one of the great translators into English of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Robert Thurman. So that's the best and most accessible translation, called The Holy Teaching of Vimalakirti, which I think is still available. He says the Sangraha Vastus can be translated as something like the way in which a bodhisattva creates a community to help him in the work of liberating living beings. Or as Sangharakshita glosses it, the way in which a bodhisattva creates a community in order to build the Buddha land, in order to create a land which is conducive, you know, to the liberation of all. Also, should just say something else here about creating community and about people. Early on in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, when the Buddha is asked, how does a bodhisattva build the Buddha land? He replies, a Buddha land, a Buddha field, is a field or a land of living beings. This is really, really important. It's not simply about structures and buildings and so on, important though those things are. It's essentially about people. You create this world with people living a Dharma life or living a good human life. That's how you create this land. It's nothing other than people. So let me go through the means of unification, the means of uniting a community, not just a fixed number of people, but a community that's reaching out to include more and more people within it, something expansive, something non-exclusive, something that opens out. It's very important to think of it like that. So the first, I'll go through the four and then go through them one by one. So the first of the means of unification is dana, or generosity. The second is priyavadita, or loving speech. The third is artacharya, which means, it's best translated as living meaningfully, or living for the goal or the good. And the fourth is samanatata, which can be translated as exemplification, but it can also be understood as equalizing yourself with others, treating others as you'd treat yourself. So I'll just go through these, you know, one by one and try and see how they can, you know, draw us closer together, to draw living beings together, to work for the benefit of all. So the first is dana, or generosity. Now, generosity is probably the most basic Buddhist virtue, the most basic Buddhist practice. In the Buddhist East, generosity is constantly praised and constantly practiced. People, it's It's one of the main practices of Buddhists in the East. Giving, 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 giving money, giving food, giving time, you know, giving energy, giving to, you know, for you know, giving for the Dharma, for the growth of the Dharma. Very, very important quality. It's sometimes said that, that generosity is the first sign of real Dharma development, of real progress, of real spiritual progress. It's quite a thought, that. You know, we tend to think real spiritual progress surely would be some mind-blowing mystical experience or some superior knowledge that you have into something. But no, the first sign, first stage of the path, really, is generosity. And that is really showing that you're beginning to become less concerned with yourself, more, a little bit more concerned with others, that you want to give. Not out of guilt, you know, or anything like that. You know, sometimes people I know can feel bad about themselves for some strange reason, and they ought to give and things like that. And if they don't, they feel bad. Not out of that. You give in Buddhist tradition out of joy. Out of joy. And it's said in particular with generosity within the means of unification, that a bodhisattva gives out of their delighted response to the potential in others, to the living being quality in others. You have to remember, like I said earlier, that skillful means comes after wisdom. It comes after compassion. Wisdom and compassion in a Buddha or Bodhisattva, they see us entirely differently. You know, we can think about the different way we relate to human beings, to living beings. Very often, if I look at myself, my habitual way is entirely in terms of, well, sorry to say it, you know, but I can tend to see people more as things rather than as people. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm sure I'm a bit better than that, but they're sort of on the edge of my attention and sense of, I don't have a vivid sense of their importance and so on. I'm much more concerned about myself, sorry to say, after all these years of practice. But a bodhisattva isn't like that. A bodhisattva, if a bodhisattva was to come into this room, he'd see all of your unique living potential. He'd see your potential for liberation from yourself, liberation from all of the conditioning in your life. He'd see you emerging into Buddhahood. That's what he'd see. That's what she would see. That would be the particular quality. So an amazing sort of, not as an idea, but as a direct, vivid apprehension. They'd have that resonance with you immediately. That's quite something to imagine. Somebody so tuned up to you in that way. So it's said in particular that the bodhisattva's great love, Vimalakirti says this in the sutra, the great love of a bodhisattva, the Mahamaitri, is the love that continually matures and ripens living beings. There's a beautiful Sanskrit word here, which I've mentioned before, paripachana, which is actually related to the modern Hindi pukka, which means cooked, ripened, matured, soft. So that's the kind of quality, that the kind of love that a bodhisattva has. So a bodhisattva's generosity is in relation to that. What they give is to that in you. They give themselves. They give themselves entirely. So it's not about particular things that are given. It's their life that is given to you to draw forth that quality of maturing and ripening along the path, which is actually the deepest part of us, the deepest element, you know, within us. And they'll do anything to bring that forth, anything at all to bring forth that, you know, that quality. So we can start to aspire to that, you know, with one another, within the community, looking at each other in a completely different way, looking at each other as people, at the sort of living being quality in one another, and being interested in that in one another, drawing that out in one another. And yes, that does have, need to have, actual expression in things. Sangharakshana, in his lecture on this, said that the spiritual community, the Sangha, is, if it really is worthy of the name, is characterized by the constant exchange of presence, a constant flow of presence, actual things and gestures and actions flowing between us. He once said in the very early days of the movement, in early days of our Sangha, when, you know, people weren't very generous, he said the Dana bowl, the generosity bowl, was the spiritual barometer of the centre. You know, that was the barometer of the spiritual weather of the centre. If it was empty, it didn't really say much about the development of the people in the centre. He put it as strongly as that. And he didn't mean that, you know, I mean, we did need money, but of course, but he didn't mean it like that. He meant this flowing quality between people, this flowing quality. And yes, that includes giving to the support of the structures of the centre. And I gather there's a lot of generosity in this centre, and, you know, there's particular generosity going on in relation to Vajrasana at the moment, building this wonderful retreat centre, which will definitely, I'm sure, be a pure Buddha field within an impure Buddha field, which you'll all benefit from. So, you know, don't be shy about being generous towards, you know, that realm that's being created. But yes, generosity, that creates a community. And I'm sure this is true of any community, not just a Buddhist community. This sense, this awareness of one another's living beingness, of each other's spiritual potential, and giving in order to, you know, draw that out. So that's the first of the means of unification. I better hurry up and go on to the second. The second is priyavadita. Priyavadita. I love this word, priyavadita. It's like saying it, priyavadita. So vadita is speech or communication. Priya is love, affection. Very strong, sweet word in Sanskrit, priya. It's a really, really lovely word. The Buddha in the earliest sutras instructs his disciples to constantly look at each other with the eye of affection, the priya chakshu, the eye of love, constant loving awareness for one another. He says without that, there's no harmony within the Sangha, no harmony within the community. Constantly recollecting what a boon it is, how fantastic it is, how incredible it is just to have companions in this life, having friends who share this life with us. Here, it's not just gazing, you know, with love, it's speaking it, saying it, talking it, telling people that you love them, not in a sort of cloying, chatting up sort of way. Not like that, but really giving voice to your, again, to your delighted awareness of others in their Dharma life, in their life, noticing, you know, their quality, noticing, you know, what they do. I mean, it really is, it's food and drink. It's food and drink to be given that encouragement, to be given that love. And I mean generally, not just going around telling everybody that, you know, hello dear, darling, and all that sort of thing. Not just, you know, not just the cliches and so on, but genuine, truthful, you know, loving speech. It is such a gift. I must say, I feel very fortunate because, you know, where I live at Padmaloka, I mean, there's so much, you know, genuine appreciation that I'm given, that we give, you know, that we give to one another. You know, and we have, but even there we have, you know, sometimes we can get a bit kind of, you know, scratchy and you know, the worst time for us, I don't know if this is a bloke thing, meal time sometimes, you know, and there's about 14 of us living together, meal times, and we can end up sort of, we can get a bit rowdy, and we can get a bit teasy of one another. And it's usually one or two people being slightly sort of picked on, and it kind of tips over into something a bit pokey. And somebody has to say, hey, 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 enough, guys, come on, enough. This is, where are we going with this? You know, it happens, you know, even in the best of places. And, you know, we are one of the best of places. We have to, or sometimes people just getting really narky. Sangharakshita says that we've all got, he reckons that human beings have got a sort of quantum of negativity, a kind of reservoir of negativity, a kind of, which is, you know, going to come out, lash out in one direction or another. Of course, it's all dressed up as objective criticism and all the rest of it, but actually, you're just getting off, you know, you're just, you know, letting off steam to somebody. But equally, we need to, you know, and you can really undermine people with that kind of resentful, slightly negative kind of talk, that undermining of others. Equally, I think human beings have a quantum of positivity, a quantum of, you know, really wanting to express love. It's such a relief, I know, sometimes when, you know, when you express affection to somebody, they're sort of liberated, because they feel, actually, I can express affection too. They want to do that. And perhaps even their own sort of resentment and negativity is because their own basic desire to express love is dammed up. You know, it's such a weird thing sometimes, people not being able to express, you know, that warmth and affection and this wonderful Buddhist virtue of rejoicing in merit. Rejoicing in merit, actually naming for somebody their qualities, actually telling it. You know, it's a really wonderful practice, rejoicing in merits. It means you have to really think about somebody in meditation, maybe in the Metta Bhavana. Sometimes it's a good thing with your friend just to go through in your mind with your good friend their qualities, his or her qualities. Just really look for them, really think about them, meditate on them, and then go and tell them. Just say, look, I think you've got this quality and that quality. And of course, they might start getting really embarrassed. Ignore that. Just tell them. Just tell them. It's such a gift. Sometimes, you know, we don't know what our qualities are. You know, when Jnanavarta introduces me, I don't know these qualities that he's seeing in. I mean, he's a very truthful man. I mean, he's Jnanavarta. You know, why, you know, the speech of wisdom, so it must be true what he's saying. it's such a gift because, you know, I'm not, you know, like we're with ourselves all the time, aren't we? So we don't know our qualities. You know, our really good qualities, they're so habitual, we don't notice them. So a good friend or anybody just saying, you've got this quality, you've got that quality. Such a wonderful gift. And what a way to create a community, to bring people together, to tell them how much you appreciate them. I've got Buddhist friends working in, you know, all sorts of, you know, as it were, ordinary jobs. And they've done rejoicing in merits with their colleagues. And they said it's had a tremendously positive effect, you know, on their work teams and so on. It's a bit shocking for the people being on the end of it, positively shocking. But it's such an important quality. So priya vadita, you know, loving speech, telling people their qualities. There's another aspect to loving speech. There is such a thing as, you know, critical speech, out of love. And I don't mean that you're basically sort of pummeling somebody and then saying, it's good for you, you know, and I don't mean like that. But sometimes, you know, you do have to point something out to somebody. You have to do that, you can only do that with love, I think, for it to be done well, to be done objectively, to be done with, you know, real care and attention. And of course you need to follow that up and help the person if you point something out to them. I sometimes feel that in some ways being critical of somebody is in a way the highest form of loving speech, and I often fail to do it because I have to do it well, you've got to be as truthful as possible, and you've got to do it without any, you've got to make sure that you're clean and pure, and you've got to make sure that you're really going to help that person understand what you're saying, and also be willing to be wrong. That's quite a tall order for you. But Priya Vadita sometimes involves pointing out very skillfully, very carefully, where somebody is going wrong. That requires real care and attention. A few times I've experienced that, actually, from Sangharakshita, our teacher. I've had his positive critical feedback on a couple of occasions, and it was the most incredible gift I've ever had. Extremely challenging, very, very challenging, because there was nothing to be resentful about in relation to him. You know, usually if somebody's got a bit of an edge, you can go for their motives.